There's one problem with pain. What is it?
It hurts.
It hurts. Just hurts a lot. And I don't like pain. I've not dealt with severe pain except one time when I fractured this wrist. And we were going to be all natural, and I was in the hospital, and it was a surgeon. We were about the same age, and he'd fractured his wrist. And I was taking Salicylic, and I was taking Boswellia complex, and I was taking all natural things. And he was ready to go to work, and he said, "So, Michael, are we going to stay natural on this?" I said, "No, this really hurts." And I discovered that what I had was Vicodinemia. I had a severe lack of Vicodin for several days. I'd never felt pain like that in my life. He said, "Yeah, I didn't think natural would work too long." He said, "I've been there. I know what that feels like." He said, "You probably won't need this but for a few days." He said, "I'll give you enough for a week," but he said, "I doubt that you'll need it in about 3 days," and I didn't need it anymore. But I try to remember that when I'm talking with a patient. Remember that I don't have a high pain threshold, but I seldom have dealt with any serious pain, so I don't know what their experience is. We have to understand, however, the pharmacology of pain, because often we may hold out hope for a patient where that's not fair. We don't really have something to offer some of these patients. It is estimated that more than 60 million people in the United States suffer from some type of pain sufficient to significantly impact their lives. $5 billion per year is spent on surgery for chronic back pain alone. And what is the failure rate for low back surgery? Well, 50% for sure, and some say it's higher, but at least half. It's a crapshoot. I have friends who are surgeons, and they tell me, "Michael, here's the deal." He said, "We're looking at a scan. We're looking at all the data we've got, and it looks like there's a lesion that is operable." And we go in, we open up, we get there. Nobody's home. It isn't there. It isn't what it looked like. So what are you supposed to do? Honestly, you're the surgeon. You've opened them up. There you are. And what you were eager to find and fix isn't there. Now what do you do? Well, you know, what you do is like move around the furniture a little bit, dust, take out the garbage, do something. He said, what we do is look for anything that, you know, is right there that maybe we can clean up a little bit. Because he said, the sad fact is the billing is going to be the same. Because the operating theater was, you know, that's just the hard facts. It will be the same. So he said, I look for any possible good thing I could do. He said, I feel like a real heel. It's not there. Didn't need to do this. He said, I would never do that knowingly. But it happens. $5 billion a year. 1 in 5 Americans over the age of 60 takes meds to control pain, mainly for arthritis and low back pain. Can herbs play a role in the management of pain? Well, they certainly did historically. Opium was fairly effective. We just recently celebrated the 100th anniversary of the 1906 quake in San Francisco. And I happened to be watching PBS. They had a special on, and I was interested in the history of that time. Just fascinating. And they showed what was a tourist's map of San Francisco the very day that it happened. Tourists coming in, and they'd be handed this. And there was one section of town, which at least in those days was called Chinatown. Now we have to call it Oriental Land. I don't, it's not politically correct. I don't know what you call it. Asian world. At any rate, it was Chinatown. And it was color-coded. The map was color-coded for what? The opium dens. Now here's what's interesting. We have the Hollywood idea of what it was like. They said, oh no, it was the cleanest, neatest part of town. And it was virtually crime-free. Who patrolled those streets? The tong. How long did you mess with the tong? 20 minutes, until the sword could come out. That was about it. Their greatest source of money was who? Who was coming to Chinatown for opium?
Tourists.
Rich, white tourists, racked with pain. Said it wasn't drug addicts. They weren't there. These were tourists coming in who wanted some relief. They wanted a weekend or a day free of pain. And the opium dens, they had real, they said frankly, herbal masters. They knew what they were doing. When you've got incredible pain, you can take a level of opium that would have me climbing the ceiling. What does it do for the pain-racked patient? They're not high at all. They're just pain-free. Their body uses all of that. So they can actually sit down and read a book and smoke a pipe or do whatever. So we get the Hollywood version. That isn't what it was. And so it was interesting. They said that was big, big business. And they patrolled the streets and kept it safe. And the police stayed out of there. We'll take care of our own. And what they said was, tourists know if there's one place in town you're safe, it's there. We'll take care of you because we need your money and we want you coming back. Now, once you step out of here and go into Caucasian land, watch out. There's really wacky people out there. It was just a strange thing. So opium, gelsemium and cannabis, that's the California state flower. Californians are issued two things at birth, a marijuana plant and a juicer. And now we get a Humvee, all right? So the majority, the beginning of the pharmaceutical industry was extraction from plants. And what was the very first one? The first commercially successful one? Aspirin, the Bayer Company, aspirin. Not willow bark, which the American Indians taught Samuel Thompson, but let's find the active chemical so we can extract it and get a patent and sell it big time, and that's exactly what they did. Now, these, of course, are powerful. We don't want to fool with these, these morphine analogs, or the opiates, are what are going to be required for serious pain. So let's look at the broad categories. Analgesics divided into the opiates and the non-opiates. Morphine and other opiates stimulate opiate receptors in the central nerve system and inhibit the perception of pain. Here's a case where the volley of impulses coming to the cortex is so incredibly overwhelming that the brain cannot process it. And there's nothing you can do peripherally to stop this. So what you do is turn off the brain. You simply tell the brain pain receptor system closed. Imagine on a battlefield. All right? Here's a young man, young woman, here she is. Limbs are blown away. He or she's going to die. You get to them. You're the medic. What are you going to do? Counseling? What are you going to give them? Morphine, how much? Here's the bag, enough to let them do as much as they want. Sometimes they know exactly how much to take to just go away. But certainly, you know, at least you can go without pain, and it'll do that. Enough morphine, and they don't feel anything. They may just pass out, but at least it's done. It is, in that case, the kindest thing to do. That's what that's for. So if we have a patient who comes in on any morphine analog, we don't have anything that's going to approximate that. That's an intense level of pain, and I can't even hope to deal with that. Now, we can still work structurally. We can do all of the things to help induce the healing to deal with the cause of the pain, but I can't try to think I can do anything for that level of pain. So they're going to come in saying, no, I can't take these drugs. What have you got? I'm going to see what it is. And if it's that, I'm going to say, I can't help you with that. I can work on the reason that you need this, but you probably are going to have to stay on this until enough healing has begun. But we can work with the second category. The non-opiate analgesics work at the periphery. Here, the problem is the peripheral nociceptors are hypersensitive. And so there are a variety of natural remedies that can help downregulate that nociceptor activity peripherally. So that's an order of magnitude below. And what I tell a new patient is, I believe I can approximate 50% of what the drugs you're on are doing. So they come in on Flexeril or whatever they're doing. I tell them, I can probably match half of that. If you want me to match it, I don't think I can. You need direct intervention, and that's what you're doing. Things natural don't work that way. But I'll bet I can do about half of that. I don't know if that's enough for you. And I don't know if you know if that's enough for you. We'll have to find out. But here's the patient who says, I can't, you know, the drugs work, but doc, I can't work. They just make me loopy. So I'm going to get fired. I can't go to work on the drugs, but if I take the drugs, I can't stay at work because the pain is too bad. Can you help me? Again, I think I can do half. And the common report from the patient is, I can handle pain. I've dealt with pain for a long time. I just can't handle this much. Then I say, it's experimental. I don't know if what I can do is enough for you. We can find out, and they're willing to do it. All right? So at least I've done, to the best of my ability, full disclosure. I'm not going to match what the drugs have done. And I don't want you to stop them right away. If your plan is to stop them, don't. You have to wean yourself off. You'll get a tremendous rebound effect, and it'll be pain worse than you've ever had. Slowly, preferably with your prescribing doctor's consultation, which I know isn't going to happen, otherwise they wouldn't be in my office. So I know what they're going to do. I just try to caution them, reduce this dose slowly. The opiates are more effective for sharp pain associated with direct mechanical stimulation of pain fibers. That's ripping, tearing, shredding. That's massive trauma. And again, we don't have anything that's going to stop that. It's overwhelming. Morphine, codeine, and other related analogs. Patient probably would get codeine as what? After dental work, what would they be given? For codeine, they'd get Tylenol 3 most commonly. Yeah. And what's the problem with that? What does that do to you?
Constipation
shuts down gastric motility. The intestines just take a nap. So the patient slowly fills up with crap. All right? They're generally used for intense pain, not opiates. Usually is going to be pain associated with a process like inflammation. And certainly that's what we deal with every stinking day when the new patient comes in. We know the pain is in part due to inflammation. And that's the one that we can help a great deal. The non-opiates will not help the tremendous pain for which only opium will work. And they are usually anti-inflammatory, and that'll be the mechanism. All right. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, of course, we know, but it is amazing to me how little patients understand that aspirin doesn't cure anything, that Advil did not correct Advilemia. And the ads make it look like, don't you love the ads? The ads are clever. You know, I couldn't, you know, unscrew a cap, but now I just take my Advil every day, and I'll do that until I'm dead, and this is a good thing. It's vitamin Advil, and that's the impression they want the public to have. Not saying it hasn't fixed a thing, it has suppressed the symptoms, it has reduced the inflammation. We have not addressed why the inflammation is there. That's not the disclaimer. Celebrex and Vioxx, a fascinating story. They inhibit prostaglandin synthesis by inhibiting cyclooxygenase, which is, where did my deuter go? I can't bring it up. All right, cyclooxygenase is the gateway into the entire eicosanoid system. It starts with arachidonic acid. Arachidonic acid, cyclooxygenase, originally it was just cyclooxygenase, then in 1991 discovered that there are two. All cells have cyclooxygenase, hence cyclooxy, the COX enzyme. That enzyme takes the arachidonic acid down into prostacyclones, prostaglandins, leukotrienes, a whole category of 20-carbon fatty acids. They work on the basis of balance. Some are pro-inflammatory, some are anti-inflammatory, some are pro-coagulative, some are anti-coagulative, and we don't know enough to micromanage, and that's where we get in trouble. We're like with COX-2. We're trying to micromanage in this huge pile of stuff we don't really understand. What the body wants is to have all of it so that it can maintain homeostasis. Well, the medics didn't want to do that. They knew that if you could block cyclooxygenase, then you would shut down at least the pro-inflammatory prostaglandin 2, but they didn't realize you're also shutting down everything else, like blood clotting capacity. So patients would bleed out. Yes, no pain, but yes, dead or near dead. So then later on in 1991, there was an attempt to bypass the negatives of blocking COX-1. They found that inflamed cells have another version of cyclooxygenase called COX-2. That's considered inducible. It's only on some cells. So the thought was, let us produce a drug that will only block COX-2, leaving COX-1, which would imply normal cells, alone. The idea was good on paper. It just doesn't work. Because when you block COX-2, you also block COX-1 and vice versa. So yes, the symptoms or the problems associated with bleeding was reduced, but it was still there. How do we know? Because there were dead people. It took a long time for the dead people to show up. All right. COX-1, COX-2, here's a little discussion. COX-2 inducible, that's the one they wanted to block. Selective COX-2 inhibitors alleviate inflammation and pain, and in theory, don't cause the side effects associated with COX-1 inhibition. But the fact is, COX-2 does block COX-1. And so we had the problem with Vioxx and Celebrex. Now, it was interesting. When Vioxx was released, the company literature, was it Pfizer? I don't remember who it was. Was it Merck? Did Merck have it first? Merck. Their early literature stated that Vioxx was not to be used longer than 10 days. They recommended 7 days. And what they said was, we know that it is safe 7 to 10 days. We do not know the long-term effects. And what they made clear was, you ought to not do that. Fascinating reading that, realizing In a sense, they weren't bad guys. They said clearly 7 to 10 days, this is a short-term only product because we don't know what happens. What happened in the field? What did physicians do? Just gave it like candy because the patients liked it. So there's a sense in which Merck wasn't the bad guy. They did fully disclose. They said, here's what we know and here's what we don't know. But nevertheless, that's what happened. Now, on the herbal side then, how can we? Patient comes in with a COX-2 inhibitor or something else, and they don't want to do this. So there are some tools I can use. I don't use California poppy, but a lot of cancer clinics do. An extract of California poppy is morphine-like in its activity, but it's not a morphine analog, not used this way. Corydalis, again, opioid-like, but they're not classified that way. Their activity is very mild, but can be useful. One we will use is willow bark, and that can be and matches non-steroidal anti-inflammatories in clinical trials. Now, when I presented this information first time to the American Back Society, this would be 4 years ago, we had the... So here I am talking to 500 MDs, orthopedic surgeons, neurosurgeons. I felt like Moses in the wrong desert. But the workshop was packed full, and they wanted some alternative. Now, I don't think it was for their patients at all. It was for them or their family and so forth, and that's fine. That's how it will start. But we had the first batches of the white willow bark, the Sally Jezik, and they were like kids in a candy store. They were grabbing as many as they could, and we told them there's one for each of you. They were taking 3, 6, whatever they could stuff in their pockets as they left. So we knew who it was for. It was for them. And especially when I showed the studies showing it matches Vioxx without the side effects. Boswellia is anti-inflammatory and probably a little, but not much, analgesic activity. So willow bark is primarily analgesic with a secondary anti-inflammatory component. Boswellia, primary anti-inflammatory with a secondary analgesic component. Well, those two work very well together. So four Sally Jezik for this acute patient and 6 Boswellia complex. Now again, all I hope for is matching about half of what the drugs were doing. I cannot anticipate it doing as well. California poppy, won't belabor that. It's not something I'd recommend using. I don't want to be in a courtroom explaining how come I was using something that is basically opioid-like. That would be a stretch, so I'm not going there. That's used in, again, a variety of clinics. Corydalis, however, is used in traditional Chinese medicine for hollow organ pain, and in particular, uterus. But it could work for stomach, could work for bladder, so forth. Contains about 20 alkaloids, but the one you want to see is tetrahydropalmitine, THP. That's the one that is thought to produce the greatest clinical effect. Works like, but it's certainly greatly reduced potency compared to opium. THP does not interact with the opioid receptors, and that's how and why we would be able to do it. If it interacted with the opioid receptors, then it would be classified as a drug, but it does not. So there is another mechanism. It's not clearly understood, but it appears to interact with the dopaminergic system, downregulate that way. We don't know for sure. Works well for neuralgia, dysmenorrhea, and headaches. Takes pretty high dose and so forth. We'll look at a product that has all of that in a minute. Now, willow bark is, of course, the natural aspirin. That's where it came from. The American Indians were astounded when they saw a company wanting to pick apart willow bark and find what part of it made it work. The American Indian healers said, stupid white man. They said, this is not going to work. It works well because all of the synergists are there, and when you take it apart, you're going to have problems. Well, we do. They all contain derivatives of salicylic acid, mainly salicin. And in clinical trials, the high dose, 4 tablets per day, a willow bark extract, has matched the effectiveness without the side effects of Celebrex and Vioxx. Numerous clinical trials now have showed, blinded studies, that it works as well. But it takes, in the literature, about a week for it to take effect. Yeah, that's what I want in my office. Brand new patient. Nervous about seeing me anyway. Acute pain. Got anything that'll help? Yeah, I do, but it'll take about a week. Well, thanks. And they're out the door. So I was not eager to even use this, reading the literature, but I find that it does not take that long. It takes about 24 hours. 24 to maybe 48. Now, I can get that out of the patient, usually. Why? Where have they already been? What have they already been doing? They've already been doing the drugs and everything else. All right, so they're willing to give me a day or two to find out if something will work for them. And does seem to work for the majority. Now, for a long time, and please don't ever say again in a new patient lecture or public lecture, well, you know, they, the bad people, the drug companies, don't even know how aspirin works. Don't say that anymore. We do know how it works. All right? It doesn't work the way it was thought, so you can use that, but we do know how it works, and it's not the way or the mechanism that we thought. Salicin from the plant effectively delivers salicylic acid into the bloodstream. It was thought that it's the salicylic acid that has the analgesic effect. Well, it may have some, but it's a very small part of the overall package, as we will see. Salicin is carried unchanged. Salicin from the plant is in the stomach. It passes through the stomach unchanged, hence is stomach friendly. No irritation like with aspirin, acetylsalicylic acid. It carries it into the distal ileum or colon where the gut flora removes the sugar, because that's a sugar glycosidase or a glycoside, and converts it into salicyl alcohol. That ends up oxidized in blood tissue and liver to produce salicylic acid in the bloodstream, where it was thought, okay, no negative consequences. Taking salicylic acid can irritate the stomach, but I'm not doing that with salicin. It's changed in the intestine. All right. Aspirin does inhibit both COX-1 and COX-2. It is the acetyl group, and we'll look at this diagrammatically. We thought it was the salicylic acid that produces the analgesic effect. Turns out it's not that, probably at all. It is the acetyl group that the Bayer company used to stabilize the extract. That was the other side. They thought it was the salicin, the salicylic acid. We'll combine it with an acetyl group to make a tablet. Now it turns out it's that acetyl group that does all of the blocking of COX-1 and COX-2. The acetyl group causes irreversible acetylation of cyclooxygenase, which inactivates it. Aspirin, therefore, does have potent analgesic and anti-inflammatory activities because it also blocks COX-2, but can cause gastric damage because it blocks too much, way too much. So recently, I've had several elderly female patients in. I'm doing Biomeridian on them. They're seated on a regular exam table, and I have a stool that's a little lower so I can get to their feet easily, hands and feet. And the first was about a month ago, elderly woman. She's in her 80s. And I lifted up her foot to put it on my knee and just kind of hiked her dress up a little just so it's not interfering. And she was blood red, hemorrhaged. And I lifted it up further. She's hemorrhaged from the knee down. And I thought, some trauma. I said, wow, what happened here? Was this an accident? She said, no, that's my aspirin. I said, excuse me? I said, what do you mean your aspirin? She said, yeah, that's my baby aspirin. I said, I don't think so. I said, how much are you taking? She said, oh, one St. Joseph's baby aspirin, that's 81 milligrams. I said, well, why are you taking that? She said, well, my real doctor told me to take baby aspirin. I said, well, I think you ought to stop. You're hemorrhaging. I said, did you show this to that doctor? She said, oh, yes. He said, it's perfectly normal. I said, ma'am, hemorrhaging is not normal. This is not normal. And I don't care who told you that. I said, you need a different doctor. Oh, he's been my doctor for 40 years. I said, well, good luck. And what am I going to say? So we just move on. She's not going to stop. I've had three others since her that are hemorrhaging in the leg and in the forearms from a single baby aspirin. And they won't stop. All right. Now, why does this happen? Platelet function is inhibited by the inhibition of production of thromboxane A2. That's one of the prostaglandins that's regulated by COX-1. So when I take aspirin and I inactivate COX-1, I block the production of thromboxane A2, and that inhibits platelet, not production, but function. Now here's the problem. Once the platelet is produced, if damaged, I can't fix it. How long do platelets last? About 10 to 14 days. Now, you know, What does your dentist tell you when you're going in for a cleaning or any procedure? The day of. They say, don't take any aspirin. That's not accurate. How long should they tell you don't take any aspirin? 2 weeks. Because the blood thinning effect from a single dose of aspirin can last 2 weeks for the affected platelets that day. Well, they're only a part because you're making some every day, but that effect goes on long term. So here, this elderly woman, and who knows why, it's causing such massive hemorrhage and hurts, not that much aspirin, but it's too much for her body. And it's just amazing that the physician would look at that and say, that's normal. You're bleeding out, that's normal. I don't like you anyway. Here it is. 7 to 10 days, the life of the platelet. Some authors say up to 14 days, so at least a week anyway would be the minimum time in any of the textbooks. So here are the compounds we're dealing with. Here's the salicin found in the plant. Now, that gets into the stomach, passes into the distal ileum or the proximal colon. It is broken down, this portion released, and then the salicylic acid is formed in the tissue. And all of the areas where it could do damage have already been passed through. Well, what the Bayer company did was take that and simply add the acetyl group, strip off the hydrogen, acetylate the salicylic acid, and that gave us acetyl salicylic acid. And the thought was, this is what you need to get the analgesic effect. But it isn't. It's this. It's the acetyl group that inactivates cyclooxygenase. And nobody ever knew that. So the whole thing is almost a scam in that it didn't work the way we even thought, even when we didn't think that we understood how it could have worked when it did work, but we didn't know that. So there. Despite that, in Michael Crichton's latest book, State of Fear, how many have read that? Okay, in Crichton's books, he always tries to make the scientific part accurate. He goes through, and I don't remember what the scene was, but he's doing a discussion of the history of drugs. And he said, it was interesting, he said, in all of modern pharmacy, there's only one true wonder drug. What is it? Aspirin. He said, used properly, more good has been done with just aspirin than any other drug. I just found that fascinating. He said, there's a time and place to use something like that. Well, that's what the patients are doing. All right. Now, unlike aspirin, here, salicylic acid. So aspirin, because of the acetyl group blocking the COX enzyme, salicylic acid has no inhibitory effect on COX-1 or COX-2. So the mystery was, well then, how did willow bark work? With aspirin, okay, so we know it was the acetyl group, and yet willow bark works in clinical trials. How is it working then, if it's not the salicylic acid? It can inhibit prostaglandin synthesis in intact cells. It does mean that there will not be blood thinning activity because it does not shut down COX-1 or COX-2, does not disturb platelet function. That's a good thing, if only it can have the analgesic effect. Well, it has been reported that aspirin and sodium salicylate equally potently suppress COX-2. Salicylates appear to have direct analgesic effects in the central nerve system by unknown mechanisms. Clinical trial says, well, it does do it. Suppresses CNS pain perception, and we don't know how it works. We didn't obviously ever know how it worked. Well, willow bark, we will talk about right after the break. So take 15, I gotta set up my timer here. All righty. Okay, back to willow bark. The differing actions of willow bark and aspirin, they work differently. And this only adds to the confusion about how aspirin worked to begin with. 35 patients were given either willow bark extract delivering 240 milligrams of salicin per day, that's the high dose, 60 milligram tablets, or placebo under double-blind conditions. Another 16 patients were given 100 milligrams of aspirin, just a tad more than the typical 81 milligram baby aspirin. The maximum arachidonic acid-induced platelet aggregations were as follows. Now, in this case, higher number, better. They're measuring how well the platelets will aggregate, how well you can clot. The lowest number from aspirin, and that's why you bleed out. When I take it, I dramatically reduce, compared to placebo, like almost by 4 to 1, my ability to clot. Willow bark, 61. There is a mild blood-thinning effect, but nothing compared to what aspirin does. Hence, although technically contraindicated for all patients who have aspirin sensitivity, you can see why it is not likely to really be a problem. So technically, yes, but practically, you probably can do it with impunity. All right. But it's more than just salicylate. A study involving 10 healthy volunteers found that a dose of a high-potency willow bark extract, and they used in the clinical trials 60 milligram salicin-containing tablets. That's what MediHerb made sure they produced to give you phytoequivalents. Four tablets per day resulted in blood salicylate levels of around 1.4 micrograms per milliliter. Well, that means nothing to us. It's a comparative study. In contrast, now remember, here's the deal. In other clinical trials, the willow bark extract reduced pain as effectively as aspirin. So we have equivalents there, analgesic equivalents, and now they're trying to find out if it's the salicylates. So here, with the willow bark, you get 1.4 micrograms. Here, taking 35, they take 500 milligrams, they get 35 to 50 micrograms of the salicylate. So what they know is it's not the salicylates. There's not enough there to produce the effect that's equivalent to aspirin. You're like a factor of 35 to 50 off. Clearly then, the clinically observed analgesic effects from willow bark must come from something other than just the effects of salicylate. Further studies suggest that lipoxygenase and hyaluronidase inhibition and free radical scavenging effects all from other components in willow bark contribute to the overall analgesic effect. So what it demonstrates is the American Indian healers were right. It's more than just one thing. You may pull out one thing that has an effect, but the plant works synergistically using lots of things. The whole plant itself was quite safe, but when I pull out one thing and megadose it, I'm going to pay a price for that. It ain't nice to fool Mother Nature, is what the American Indians originally said, and the butter people stole that. This means that many of the side effects, interactions, and contraindications for aspirin, such as negative interactions with methotrexate for the RA cases, spironolactone, and furosemide, are unlikely to apply for willow bark. Again, MediHerb will technically say contraindicated in those cases, but from a practical standpoint, it's probably quite safe. It's a different mechanism of action. Now, in the clinical trials, in 78 patients with osteoarthritis of the knee and or hip, a potent willow bark extract containing high dose, 4 60 milligram tablets versus placebo, double-blind trial. The WOMAC pain index used as the outcomes indicator after 2 weeks dropped by 14% for willow bark versus 2% increase for placebo with a good kappa. So this began to get everybody's attention. They said, well, wait a minute, we're way beyond just placebo here. Something real is happening. Now, if you go to the MediHerb website via or go through standard process, if you don't already have them, you can download all of the monographs on willow bark. And you can show any physician who wants to look, oh no, dimwit, this is not placebo. You're not current on the literature. It does work. But just like drugs, it doesn't work for everybody. You have multiple painkillers that you use because on some patients, product A does nothing, but product B works better. Same thing here. It doesn't work for everybody. This was a landmark study, 191 patients, double-blind conditions. They gave both low dose and high dose. The low dose was 2 60 milligram tablets. The high dose was 4, compared against a placebo. Tramadol, a European-used medication, was the rescue product. After 4 weeks, the number of pain-free patients was an amazing 39% for the high-dose group and 21% for the low-dose group versus only 6% for placebo. Took only 1 week of treatment for the high-dose group. Well, of course, clinical trials are always skewed a little bit because everybody knows they're part of a trial, and so there's some error built in just in doing that. But seeing this, it was clear that it works, and it's way beyond placebo, but the disappointing part was needing a week for it to work. So I remember when we first got the product, I got the very first bottle, took it home, and my wife had some pain in her body somewhere. And I said, well, here, try this. I just got it. I said, I don't have any need for it, but try it. Let's do the high dose. Let's assume your pain is really severe. And if it's not here, let me hit you. And we'll make it severe. So I said, take four of these. And so she took two and then two a little bit later. And the next day she got up and she said, wow, that's pretty good stuff. She said, I had a little bit left, but basically I'm feeling pretty good. You know, I'll do some more, but that works pretty well. And so then I made the mistake of informing my wife that this is purely placebo. It takes about a week for it to work. And I found out what a tragic error of judgment that was. She accused me of telling her she's crazy, that it's all in her head, and so forth. And so I never tell her anything about anything anymore. Now when I give her something that's known to take, like if I give her valerian complex and it takes a month to work, and if she passes out as she's swallowing it, I'll say, dang, that's good stuff. I find about a day. Really about 24 hours. You need some time to get it in the system. But again, as I mentioned earlier, these patients have been drugged up. They'll give you some time. And I tell them, don't stop taking what you're currently taking. You'll get too big of a rebound effect. Stay on what you're taking. Add this as an adjunct. And then begin to back off on whatever med you're currently using. That's just more data of the same. Here was a clinical trial comparing with Vioxx directly. An open randomized controlled trial compared with willow bark at the high dose and Vioxx at the usual dose. 114 patients with low back pain. After 4 weeks of treatment, there was no difference observed between the results of the two products in terms of pain, the need for additional analgesic, or side effects. Well, that's because the side effects of long-term Vioxx use take longer. It takes longer to kill you. The dead people show up a little bit later. But it matched. Now, when I showed this at the American Back Society, this was actually in the American Journal of Medicine. The references are in the monographs from MediHerb for this. One of the guys there writes for that magazine, and he said, that's all I need. He said, you see, what we need as surgeons is clinical justification to use something that's outside standard of care. He said, you know, I can do anything, but I better have something to back me up. He said, you have an advantage. You can kind of do anything, because we don't know what the hell you're doing anyway. He said, really, that's just the way it is. But he said, we can't. He said, especially in a hospital, he said, I can do anything, but if there's an action brought against me, if it wasn't standard of care or something new but clinically justified, he said, I go down. He said, that's all I need. This is good peer-reviewed work. I wasn't just winging it. I wasn't being wild and crazy. There's clinical justification for doing this. I think we so often lose sight of their world. That's not a happy world. They can't do much of anything that's innovative and often have to do things that they don't want to do because that's standard of care, even though they may feel it's wrong for this patient. You better have done it, otherwise you're open to malpractice. We have freedom, and I don't want them knowing too much about us. Thank you very much. In all the trials, a high-potency willow bark extract was used. It was standardized to 15% salicin, and they used the high dose. All right. What you want, and here's what you don't get if you're not careful, is phytoequivalence. The full phytochemical profile of the willow bark extract should match the profile of the extract used in the clinical trials. Here's what I most appreciate about what MediHerb does, even though it's a real pain for them. And again, I've been in the lab doing some of this work, not that I knew what I was doing, but they would say, push that button now, thank you, which allows me to say I helped do this work. And I did get to wear a white smock and walk around and get pictures taken. I did do some HPLC work there, some high-performance liquid chromatography. And they said that they always strive for phytoequivalence. What they will do is look at the clinical trials, they will get the data and see what was used, and then they will not release a product until as best they can. They've matched the phytochemical profile. That means that I can use that clinical trial to support the product I'm giving the patient. I can say, because I'm giving you with 99% accuracy what they used, I can expect the result that they got in general. The problem is, manufacturers in this country don't have to meet that standard. They do in Australia, but they don't here. And so often you're using a product from another company that doesn't do that kind of expensive, extensive analysis, and you don't get the result. And then what do you tend to do? Throw out the baby with the bathwater. Well, I tried that and it doesn't work. No, in most cases, you never tried that. You thought you were trying that, and you didn't give it a fair shake. The last thing in the world we need to do is, having figured out what might potentially help the patient, then wonder if I actually have that thing that could help them. I don't have to worry about that. Now, there will never, or I don't expect there will be many studies of that level on the food side. People will ask me all the time, why doesn't Standard Process do the clinical trials and do the studies and do the research on this? God help us if they ever do this too much. You talk about opening the barn door. They have to be really careful about what they study. You'll see studies on things like purple carrots, the carotenoid level of purple carrots. Why? Because it doesn't matter. Well, why aren't there studies on the protomorphogens? Please, never, ever. Because what would happen? If clinical trials were done that were so noteworthy that the pharmaceutical industry took notice, what would happen? Goodbye. We don't want to go there. We don't want you. We would lose it. They would hire the high-powered lawyers, prior rights. This has a medicinal effect. This is a drug-like effect. And there you go. They could tie up and bankrupt the company. It would be so, that would be chicken feed to them. So we don't want to go there. The other reason is it costs so much money. How much does it cost to do a large base, double-blind clinical trial?
Phase 1, 2, 3,
all the way up. Yeah, $20 million, $10 to $20 million. Standard Process can't do that. They're just so proud of having built a new $5 million laboratory. And it's really nice. It impresses the snot out of me. But that's a closet to Eli Lilly. All right, so we have no idea how much money it takes to do this. So the clinical trials that can be done are done where? Your office, my office. And we report it in anecdotally, and that can lead them to maybe try something bigger. They try to engage universities. They're working with some of the chiropractic colleges. I'm not sure that's a good idea necessarily to do the kind of research that might be accepted, but it's a start. It's a start, but then you have to find out the philosophical orientation of the college. That can be an interference, right? So there you go. This is known as phytoequivalence, and here's the thing. Now, this is in the new MediHerb catalog. And if you haven't, if you don't have the new MediHerb catalog, get it. It's out there, and take the time to study through it. Just, you know, the way you learn these things, you put that catalog on the back of every toilet. I'm serious. And every time you're in there doing your business, it's just time enough to read about a product or something. And all the articles were written on the toilet. So they're just about the right length. So here, the brown trace up here was the phytochemical profile of what was used in the clinical trial. So this one, you know, produces the result that they got. Here's MediHerb's product. These overlap. You just can't do much better than that. Okay, here's a peak missing, but you can look almost peak for peak. Other people look at that and they say, dang, that's really good. That's 99% phytoequivalence. It's hard to do any better than that. You can, the kind of variance you see there, you can vary from batch to batch. And so that's what they strive to do. So now I know that if willow bark can possibly work for a patient, I've got the right product. There's no question about that. Well, with that comes what? That is not such a happy report. Expense. You want cheap stuff? Patients will look at willow bark and they'll say, dude, I can get this for $1.50 at GNC. I know you can. You can get a bottle that says willow bark on the label, but you are not getting phytoequivalence. To get that, it costs a lot of money, and I'm sorry. So the willow bark large bottle, how much is it? Yeah, it's basically $1 a pill, right? Yeah, that's one I do know. Because it hurts. I know the price of Vimuplex, large bottle, $40, and I know this one, $100. But you know what? I never get a complaint from a patient. It amazes me. So sometimes I make the complaint for them. I'll say, I'm going to recommend this, but it's really expensive. And they say, okay. Yeah, really expensive. Okay. Really? I mean, you can't even afford it. Okay. So anyway, I guess it's because I tell them you're going to do this short term, you're not doing this long term, and I mean that when I tell them you're going to buy one large bottle, and I doubt that you're going to use half of it because we're going to move on to other things, and just keep it in the refrigerator. I don't even know what its shelf life is, but keep it cool anyway. They just don't seem to care. It's not about the money. It's just not about the money. It's about them believing that you believe at least what you say. And they need somebody to help them. It's an amazing thing. That's phytoequivalence. Use that as a good example. And when I show that to patients, they get it. They don't understand all the language in HPLC, but they understand that's what you want and that's what I'm giving you. The and that's it. They say, got it. I say, now, if you think what they've got at the health food store is the same thing, you can take this catalog down and ask them to show you proof of phytoequivalence with their product. Now, A, the high school work study person who's there will not know what you're talking about, and B, they don't have it. All right? So that ends the discussion. Okay, so that's Sally Jezik, and the clinical trials used 60 milligram salicin tablets. We don't know why. I asked Carrie, and he said, I don't know why, that's what they used. So Carrie and his team matched that. They used low dose 2 tablets per day and said it can take up to 2 weeks for the full analgesic effect. 4 tablets, the high dose, 1 week. I don't find it takes that long, as I mentioned. Well, when I'm using it, I'm always using 4. If I'm going to use it, I use the 4 tablets. I don't have anybody do more because there's no evidence that more is going to work any better. So I do have them do 4. That means that large bottle could last them almost a month. They don't seem to care, $100, but it's almost a month's worth. They don't seem to care. All right. Dose 2 to 4 tablets daily. Now, the Corydalis, somebody asked me, where are we going to get that? That's in a different product called Cramplex. I wonder what that could be for. I remember when the product was in development, Carrie and I were doing a joint seminar somewhere in Texas, and we're riding around in the car going to dinner, and he said, all right, we have to have a name for this product. Okay, so it's largely for menstrual cramping. We had a variety of names that were even more funny after a little wine. None of which could probably be talked about here. So we kept driving around because we were having so much fun. We had a designated driver, and we're just having a hootenanny, coming up with names for a product for menstrual cramping. He decided to just call it Cramplex. Let's just keep it simple. Well, it is the Corydalis, wild yam, raspberry leaf, cramp bark, and ginger. Now, they had been using this blend in Australia as a liquid. And Amanda and some others said, this as a liquid blend may have been the worst tasting product in the history of mankind. They said the product alone induced facial cramping. And they said that for the women who used it, it seemed to work well. They believed that it really helped, but its compliance was just not very good at all. So they had worked long and hard to get that in a tablet form. Now, every step of manufacturing with an herbal product disturbs the phytochemical profile. Every time you mess with what nature has provided, you mess it up a little, because it's not our job. So in the first step, you lose a little bit of what was there naturally as opposed to just eating the plant. So getting it to the tablet, to the liquid form, is minimal interference. The next step, getting it to tablet, is another possibility of disturbing the phytochemical profile. So when they have it in the liquid form, they always verify with HPLC that, no, we have what was in the plant with minor loss. Going to tableting, they have to check it again. They had a tough time maintaining the phytochemical profile. They had the liquids for this. That was fine, but nasty. When they'd get it to the tablet form, which is more processing, they found that they had moved the phytochemical profile and lost equivalent. So he said the tough part was finding how we had to do it to keep the phytochemical profile. And I've been there, and he said it's just a matter of extracting over and over and over, changing the concentration, finding what will work, and they finally found it. So now the difficulty is getting the woman to take it properly. It takes a relatively high dose for a short period of time. 2 tablets every 4 hours, up to 4 times per day, but you have to start ideally one day before you actually need it. So how do you do that? Well, if the woman's cycle is regular, she knows. She knows when the day before is. Ladies, how many of you know, even if your cycle's irregular, you know the day before? You kind of know. All right, now how would I know? You know blue balls? I don't know. You don't know blue balls. I don't know how you know this. But my wife always knows. She says, uh-oh, I'm within a day. Okay, so most women will know, and that's the day for her to start taking if cramping is an issue. And I'd want her to do 8 tablets. Do it the day before, 8 the day of, and 8 the day after. And normally, she'll report her history. She'll say, well, it's only the first day or the second day or some limited period of time. But for it to be effective, you have to have the phytochemicals to be most effective in the bloodstream already. It seems to not work as well if it's already engaged, already cramping. In my office, it does not seem to work well. So you've got to have it there ahead of time. So you may have to experiment with a bottle or two. She doesn't mind the cost because it's short-term use, few days, and it's in the stinking small bottles anyway. So that's Cramplex. Now, that can work for any smooth muscle pain. So it's more than just the uterus. That could work for bladder pain. Some report it's effective with low back pain even. I would not think so, but it is reported to work. Now, here's a fascinating discussion. Royal Lee, yes?
About neuropathy.
For the pain of neuropathy, it's worth a try. Because pain, again, if we can downregulate the nociceptors, however that happens, then it'll work. So no harm done. But I wouldn't do more than a bottle's worth. It's a small bottle. I wouldn't waste any more money. If a bottle's worth didn't help, then I wouldn't continue. Unlike the willow bark, where you have to do it for a week or so, this tends to work fairly rapidly. Royal Lee on pain. Here's a fascinating discussion. I had to sit down and think about what he was saying and realize how correct he was. Our definition of pain from the Therapeutic Food Manual: the nerve system reaction occurring when there is a contact chemically between the nerve endings and a cell component materials that are normally retained within cell walls. Here's what he's saying. Function of the nerve system, the nociceptors. What are they looking for? That's what he's talking about. Well, what's the purpose of pain? It's to let me know what has happened. Some kind of damage, right?
Yeah.
The function of the nociceptors is to detect damage. Any kind of cell damage must involve rupturing the cell membrane and the release of intracellular components. Otherwise, there's no bobo. Something has ruptured, there are broken cells, or there's no bobo. Whether it's a bruise or anything, something's broken. Lee's idea was the nociceptors are tweaked and most highly sensitized to detect intracellular components. Because the only way they can be out there is if cell membranes have been broken via some mechanism, toxicity, trauma, whatever it may be. All right, now, cells die all the time. There's the normal, healthy cell apoptotic mechanism. They need to die off and be replaced. So that means there's some minimal set point. There's some level below which, let's say this is the nociceptor, and it's only going to be triggered if the level of intracellular components gets up to here. Normal apoptotic mechanism will have those levels down here, so this guy's not sensitized. But a certain level of cell damage, and it rises up, and this guy starts sending his signals to the brain to let the brain know, don't know what's going on, but here's the area, there's cell damage, send in the troops to find out what's going on. That was his idea. And he said, some foreign irritant, something has caused these cells to burst. So, obviously mechanical injury or trauma, massive cell disruption. Thermal damage. I don't know, I haven't been around burn patients, but those who've been there tell me you've not seen pain like within a severe burn patient. Why? Massive destruction of cells all over the place. That's the kind of pain for which only what is going to work? Morphine. And how much do you give them? Whatever. Lots. All right? Pain so much that they want to die, that they cannot live. All right? And his idea was massive disruption. I mean, the nociceptors everywhere are not only just damaged themselves, but they've got massive contact with intracellular components, and the brain is being bombarded. All right? Willow bark is not going to work for these cases. Aspirin is not going to help. And nothing other than the opiates will shut that down. Electrolytic transfer or electrolyte problems can cause disruption of cell membrane. Cell damage by a variety of microorganisms. Typical case would be the crisis-like pain of, well, things like sickle cell anemia, but malaria, where the erythrocytes burst, they release, they go through the merozoite cycle, and you have the crisis-type pain. Now, these cell components are toxins because that's what the nerve system is looking for. It wants to know if there's cell damage. If there is not cell damage, frankly, your body doesn't care what's going on. If the cells aren't damaged, if there's nothing beyond the normal level of intracellular components, the body couldn't care less what's happening externally. Everything is okay. But watch this. The disposal of these toxins causes the depletion of many hormone reserves, particularly the adrenal sympathetic systems. It must be remembered that the chief function of the whole endocrine system is the elimination of toxins. I don't think I learned that in Indo in school. The chief function of the whole endocrine system is to eliminate toxins. Well, think about it. Everything balancing to make sure that the liver and the kidneys can work, everything working to detox. Think now in terms of Rechevig's table of homotoxicology. Think now of this 200-year-old assertion that all of what we call disease is but a manifestation of the body's effort to clear toxins. And when that was done, the body get well if they were nourished. Now we've got a different world where they're starving and toxic laden. But I see these things coming together. Everybody's saying the same thing. So, a toxic body over a long period of time is going to exhaust the sympathetic adrenal system. We see that all the time. And it's going to exhaust overall the entire endocrine system. So things like Simplex F and Simplex M may be far more important than we think because of the ability to globally enhance homeostasis. We may need it more than ever. Fascinating concept. But look, he takes it further. Pain reactions or nociceptor reactivity is made even worse if the surrounding tissue is alkaline. We are an acid system. We're designed to be that way. And when we become alkaline and have low blood calcium, that really sets off the nociceptors. It lowers their set point, apparently. It lowers it to the point where now even what is normal apoptotic debris can cause massive pain signals. So we have to acidify these patients. What's the cheapest way to do it? Not Calamo, not the cheapest way. Come on, don't be such a purist. Apple cider vinegar, jeez. You know, I got lots of stuff to sell these people. You, however, try to sell them everything, I can tell. Don't eat, I've got pills. No food, I've got all the food you need right here. So apple cider vinegar. Two books. If you didn't read them, please get D.C. Jarvis's two books. The first was Vermont Folk Medicine, or just Folk Medicine. That one's out there. And his second book was Arthritis and Vermont Folk Medicine. And he said it's simply a matter of getting the proper acids back into this body. For some reason, they have swung hyperalkaline and it's not working. Dr. Lee insisted that dying cancer patients usually end up hyperalkaline, and the system can't handle that. Oh, God, there are endless books. Alkalinize or die, eat green or be mean, and all this crap I get. Oh, geez, it's all...
How do you tell your patients if they're full of crap?
That's what I tell them.
That's what I do.
This guy's full of crap. Here's the deal. You catch the mistakes in the first chapter, all right? The information is usually overwhelming for the layperson, and frankly, we've forgotten lots of this, and we could follow it, but we'd have to dig out the textbooks and catch up. You catch the errors in chapter one. Here's what happens. Once you get through chapter one and accept the premise, All right. But the errors are usually in the first chapter. And they'll say things like, well, of course, eating excessive protein will make you hyperacidic. Now, if you don't stop there and say, whoa, wait a minute. Where'd you get that from? If you don't stop there, you see, if you don't stop and challenge every premise postulated, then you're lost because you've already bought it, hook, line, and sinker. So you challenge every statement of purported fact they make and say, whoa, show me that. I don't know where that came from. Well, studies confirm. Which studies confirm? You may be right, but I'm going to have to see that because it doesn't make sense to me. Now, let's ask the fundamental question about pH. I mean, we can resolve it without a single stinking study. We don't need no stinking studies. Only one pH in the body really matters. Which one is it? Yeah, pH of the blood. Why does that matter? There we go. It's enzyme activity. It's all about enzymes. It's not about anything else. You learned this in school, but the isokinetic curve for enzyme activity is like a bell-shaped curve. Now, the reaction rate for enzyme reactions, A plus B forming C plus D, is a function of the hydrogen ion concentration. It's just because that changes the chemical configuration, or actually the three-dimensional configuration of proteins. More protons binding to various sites on the protein actually alter its structure. And as a result of that, the reactivity changes. It just really can't do it, or can do it faster. Are you with me? More protons, which means a lower pH, actually changes the physical structure of the enzyme, and that's a direct mechanical effect. So there is, for any enzyme, an actual peak or optimal pH where it works the best. It works at any pH, but there will be one pH where it maximally works. All right? Now, in this body, how many biochemical reactions are taking place at one time?
Millions.
A million? How about if I said 2 million?
Millions.
How about if I said a billion? Yeah, who knows?
Where's the study?
Yeah, where's the study? Where's the study? There you go. You're learning. Where's the study? We have no idea how incredibly complex this is. Homeostasis is defined as what? When all of the incredible number of biochemical reactions are taking place synchronously, harmoniously, relating one to the other, and that can only happen in an aqueous system at a very defined pH range. Why? Because that's the way it's made. Ask God. Don't ask me. If you came from a slime layer, ask the rock. I don't know. But wherever, this system is designed to operate in a very, very slim range because it's an aqueous system. And so if pH changes very much, there is no problem, and pH itself is absolutely irrelevant. It doesn't matter, except it's an index for loss of homeostasis. If the pH is shifted, it means that reaction is now slower, but this one's now faster, and where's homeostasis? It's gone, and systems begin to fail. pH is the tail wagging the dog. It's a good index for the status of the system, but I don't want to try to micromanage pH. That's backward. I want to find out why the system has lost its balance. But pH itself doesn't matter. All right. Now, the pH of the blood is critical. Normally, it's 7.38 to 7.4. Question?
So, therefore, you don't check the pH levels of this paper?
I do not, but I'll tell you why. It's not that it's not good information, and I'll tell you where it could play in. Remember, it's an index for where that body is, but I don't want to test it to micromanage that. So it's yes and no at the same time, but let me complete the discussion. pH of the blood, normally 7.38 to 7.4. Why? Because that's when things work synchronously. If it shifts very much, I've lost synchronicity. And some reactions are not going to take place in time to carry on other reactions. Not because of pH, because I've shifted enzyme balance and I can't do it anymore. pH doesn't matter, but I've shifted. All right. If pH of the blood is critical, and it is because if it changes too much, we go into a coma and die, then let's go back in the misty dawn of time, wherever you think we came from, first humans here, however and whatever you think, whatever movie version you want, here we are. If pH is critical, and it is, if my choice of a meal could affect the pH of the blood, how many humans would be on Earth today?
Zero.
Zero. We would never have survived as a species. Think about it. You don't need any papers for that one. All right. Honey, I'm going out to get some food. How's your pH? What did early man and woman eat? What did we eat 100 years ago? Whatever was there. We ate what we could find, and we did just fine, thank you very much. I'm telling you, diet has nothing to do with pH of the system. You have 7 levels of buffers to protect you. Now, here's what is true. If you are nutritionally starved, you begin to lose buffer capacity. Now you can't balance what you eat. Now you have problems, but those problems are pathology. They're not your food. You're eating the same food, but now you can't buffer. So in the longer seminar, we went through all of those buffer systems, many, many, multiple layers of buffers. Everything you do eat affects what? The buffer systems. What is the most rapidly responding buffer? It's not saliva. What is it? Urine. Urine changes just like this. So to get a spot urine pH is fairly useless information. I have to know what you ate or what you drank, what's going on metabolically to know what it should be now, because that's the rapid responding buffer. Saliva a little slower. And so these things are useful as an index overall, but only as part of the gestalt. Now, there are whole systems that want to micromanage pH first. I don't agree with that. That makes no biochemical sense to me at all. Because that's not how the body works. We wouldn't be here to be doing those studies. Lee didn't think so either. And he said, basically, when we eat what humans have always eaten, pH is irrelevant because we always eat so-called acid-forming foods and alkaline-forming foods. And so what we had, depending on what you did out there today, pH was irrelevant because you ate the chicken and the shrimp, which are proton donors, therefore technically acid-forming foods, and nobody knows for sure if that even matters. But even if it did, you also ate vegetables, which are proton-receiving alkaline ash-forming foods. So what was the net pH effect of such a lunch? Neutral. So tonight I intend to eat a large dead thing. I'm not sure what it'll be, but we'll like it, won't we, Donna? It'll be a big dead thing. And that will be a proton donor. But I'm also going to have a huge bowl of asparagus, broccoli, whatever they've got. That receives the protons. The net pH effect of my meal tonight is, always will be, neutral. It's not an issue. All right? That's eating like a human. Now, if you're going to try to live on crap, you may ultimately have pH problems because you can't buffer anymore. So eat like a human and don't worry about it. Well, interesting. Dr. Lee said high alkalinity is what's worse. So here we have the books, Alkalinize or Die. I would say alkalinize and die. Now, what you always have to look at is what are they selling you? Every one of these is usually selling something. Well, I'm selling something. You're selling something. We're all salespeople. You may not like admitting that, but you're a salesperson. You ought to be a good one. You're selling your profession. You're selling products for the patient's benefit. That's the way the world works. But these books usually are associated with some multi-level green powder, yucky, disgusting slime layer thing to make you alkaline. Okay? I'm just not concerned with that at all. It's no part of my practice at all. All right? So let's take a look. Let's put it all together. I may have calcium deficit, and so calcium lactate, tablet or powder. If I do 12 calcium lactate, now I'm going to ask the patient what they eat. If they've got, how much dairy does it take to get a gram per day? What do I have to eat? Somebody tell me. How much dairy would I have to eat to get a gram of calcium? How many ounces? 10 ounces. Most dairy, good cheeses, raw milk will give you about 100 milligrams per ounce. That's a good rule of thumb. So I need about 10 ounces. That's not much for me. I like good cheeses. Man, if there's that much brie sitting around, watch out. I'll have that stabbed on a fork running away. Any brie lovers here? Yeah, Christmas is coming. Whole Foods will have cranberry walnut stuffed crippled cream brie. It makes you cry just knowing it's there. All right? And if not, I don't like to do more than 12 calcium lactate. That'll be 50%. That's about 500 milligrams. I tell the patient, look, I'm willing to supplement you half, but I want you to eat the other half. You have to learn to eat properly. So we go through the list of calcium-containing foods. You can get it from any textbook. Eat some of these foods. Get a gram's worth. Oh, don't I have to, like, think about it? I recommend thinking. You've never done it. You should try this. Cataplex F. What's the greatest food source of vitamin F? Single best food source of vitamin F?
Butter.
Butter. Yeah, eat butter. Who likes butter here? It's what Jesus ate. Butter, lots of butter. Oh, butter, but I thought, in this interaction, one brain shall be active. It shall be mine. You have demonstrated that yours does not work efficiently or effectively. Turn yours off. Do what I tell you to do. Eat butter. So I want you to have broccoli. Bobbing in butter should be like bobbing for broccoli. If you eat a sweet potato, it should be floating in butter. But I thought, no. Don't you do that. It's dangerous. Eat butter, rich in vitamin F. If they won't eat butter, then cataplex F. What does F do for calcium? Gets it into the tissue. Vitamin D, remember, helps pick it up from the food, get it through the enterocyte lining of the intestine into the bloodstream, but it's stuck there. We need F to get it from the blood back into bone, prostate, wherever it's going. So it's the DF pathway. I need vitamin D and F. You can't believe the current research, even more from the last time Mark talked about it on vitamin D. Vitamin D is becoming the answer to everything. It's the answer to ugly. It's everything. I was reading two new papers this morning. I didn't have a chance to review them. It's vitamin D, vitamin D, vitamin D. There was some new bizarre thing that they're saying it's vitamin D. How much vitamin D does it look like we actually need?
15 minutes.
20 minutes.
I need 15 minutes of vitamin D. Okay, we'll work with that. Yeah. What is the current RDA? 400 international units. In the newest of the biochemistry textbooks, Thomas Devlin's 6th edition textbook of biochemistry with clinical correlations, which I highly recommend. Here is the ISBN number. I wish. Excellent textbook. Even Devlin says a minimum of 1,000. He said it's got to be at least 1,000. Some say it needs to be 4,000. What does that mean we know about vitamin D? Nothing. We don't know how much we need. But Devlin, who's pretty conservative in a good sense like us, he would lean toward optimal. He thinks it's got to be at least 1,000. And yet you'll have physicians telling patients, oh, make sure you don't do more than 1,200. Yeah. So probably 1,000 is safe for us. Why? Because it's in Devlin's textbook, and that's currently used in med schools. So I think you can do 1,000 with impunity. You could stretch that to 3 cataplex D, which is 1,200. All right? And every time I think about that, I keep reminding myself to take more, but I don't. I eat a lot of fish. I probably get that. Cataplex F and the 3 cataplex D. Now, here's a couple of studies there on your CD. This one, vitamin D and low back pain. It's fascinating just looking at where it is. Vitamin D deficiency and chronic low back pain in Saudi Arabia. Sunny Saudi Arabia. One would think they would not have difficulty getting 15 minutes exposure in the desert. Who's having the problem? The women. What are they wearing?
Sunscreen.
They're not wearing sunscreen.
Everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to get started on politics, but they're nuts. But despite that, wearing the burqa, and when is the woman allowed outside? She can't. So vitamin D deficiency is a major contributor to chronic low back pain in areas where vitamin D deficiency is endemic, Saudi Arabia. Screening for vitamin D deficiency and treatment with supplements should be mandatory in this setting. Measuring the D2 level from the liver, it's stored there 2 weeks, that's a relatively inexpensive test, is sensitive and specific for detection of vitamin D deficiency, and hence for presumed osteomalacia in patients with chronic low back pain. All right, here's another one. That was Saudi Arabia. This one is worth having just for the title. Musculoskeletal pain in, oh, come on, get out there, in female asylum seekers. So does that mean like they wish to be crazy and they want to get in? All right. Well, I saw the title, I said, wait a minute, what is this about? That's not what it's about. These are third world ladies coming in. A deficiency of vitamin D, which can lead to osteomalacia, is common in elderly patients in Western countries. However, it is still widely underdiagnosed in young immigrant women, even though the condition has been extensively reported in the immigrant Indo-Asian population in the UK since the 1960s. Why? Because the same dress, they are not in the sun, they're not allowed out. The study says asylum seekers are at risk because of the possible high prevalence of hypovitaminosis D and difficulty in recognizing the condition. Pain due to hypovitaminosis D is well defined. Generally, this pain is symmetrical, starts in the low back, spreads to the pelvis, upper legs, and up to the ribs. It is felt mainly in the bones, not in the joints. Patients may also have proximal muscle weakness. You have the full study there. And so especially based on where they've come from, their ethnic background, you might suspect low vitamin D status. So what would you ask them to eat? Let's not do supplements. What are you going to have them eat for vitamin D? Wow, we're in trouble. What are you going to have them eat? Eggs? Not enough there. A little bit in butter, not much. Yeah, cod liver oil. Fish. 3.5 ounces of fish daily. So we're back to fish. But cod liver oil, Dr. Lee considered a tablespoon of cod liver oil to be almost mandatory for health. Yeah, gag me. I got insurance. Hospital food isn't that bad. So now, how many of you do cod liver oil regularly? Yeah, what kind do you use? Blue ice? Is that, what flavors do they have?
Fish.
Fish flavor. That's good. That's novel. Yeah. I like a Carlson's lemon flavored. Nordic Naturals has orange flavored. You can get strawberry orange. I'm looking for chocolate. I'd like meat flavored, pepperoni, cod liver orange. Nobody's done that yet. A tablespoon a day, and you can get it in capsules now and so forth. So for these patients, cod liver oil or Cataplex D, I mean, we've got several ways we can do it. And then you want to acidify. Again, the idea there, Cal Ammo, if they won't do the apple cider vinegar. Lee developed that. It really was about the time Jarvis's book came out, and people didn't want to do or couldn't conveniently do apple cider vinegar, so he produced Cal Ammo to acidify them. It was primarily an acidifying product. He recommended apple cider vinegar and said, well, if you won't do that, then do this. But please, please read Jarvis's, at least his first book, to understand how he discovered why apple cider vinegar was so important. Chlorophyll oil. I know Dr. Goodhart talked a lot about chlorophyll oil. And here, to help detox, remember the whole issue here is clearing out internal toxins. For those of you who heard George talk about guanidine, Dr. Lee talked about that years ago. And chlorophyll helps neutralize guanidine. In essence, it helps detoxify. The chlorophyll, you know, how many have been to the plant? Standard process and seen the tour. Were you there when they were making chlorophyll? You have to go on a day when they're doing it. It's like being in the land of Oz, this emerald green liquid, because it was in glass tubes in those days. It's just, it's almost hypnotic. You look at it and you feel like there's life in there. It was the blood of the plant. It's got to be good for the blood of the human. Consider whole desiccated adrenal for this patient with chronic pain. Why? Remember, Dr. Lee said it stresses the sympathetic adrenal system. They probably will fail Ragland's test, the postural hypotension test. They will show up as weak adrenal, not adrenal disease, not Cushing's or Addison's disease, but whole adrenal might serve them better for a little while. On the Mediherb side, well, we've talked about two, Salicylic and Boswellia complex. So here's this long list of stuff. Here's a new patient. They come in on the strength of a referral. In our practice, we do not advertise, so you have to have been referred to us to even find us. Occasionally, we get drop-ins. I don't like drop-ins. I don't like... Worst patients I ever had came from an ad. Oh, please, you can shove them all in a sock and throw it in the river. I don't want them. I don't want them. I only want patients who come by referral. But my son, when he graduates, who wants to practice with us, he said, Dad, I'm going to practice just like you. I said, you will starve to death. You better take out an ad and go walk around the town carrying a spine naked. Do whatever you can. All right? Because it's different for you. So when they come in on the strength of a good referral, how much credit does that give you?
Big.
Well, it's big, but how big? How many visits do you get on the basis of a strong referral? With no results, okay? Think about it. Three? I think about three visits on a good referral. They'll give you three because they trust their friend, or they may have seen the results with a friend. Now, that's the most powerful thing. They've seen it happen. And that gets you so much time, but you better get some results. So with a new pain patient, I'm liable to jump right to at least Boswellia complex, but that's mostly anti-inflammatory. So I have to evaluate the source of the pain. If the pain is because of inflammation, I can do well with just Boswellia complex day one. Now, I'm going to launch into lots of this, but I can't do all of this on day one. We just met today. You're a what? What kind of doctor are you? You know, I'm talking about that kind of patient. So there are a lot of hurdles we have to work through. So I tell them, I'm going to adjust your spine. They're going to watch all my magic videos, which instantly shift their paradigm. Don't you have those videos that instantly change their whole orientation? Right? Isn't that what we wish? When we come out of school, well, I just show them the videos and they'll get it. And hit them with a green book. Bam! All right, now they got it. So I'll talk about using an anti-inflammatory. That's language they know. I'm going to give you an anti-inflammatory herbal preparation. It isn't fixing anything, but it can help ease the discomfort. The healing is going to take, and blah, 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 and we go on and on, and then they get it, or at least they nod their head appropriately, because I've got a string tied and I'm pulling down. Okay, you understand. Good. Take these things. Now, if it's severe, then I'll introduce the Salicylic, and I'll let them know that's expensive. It doesn't seem to be an issue, as long as I have reason to believe it'll help. Then we can move into the others. That would be maybe second visit, third visit. I don't like miracle cases, never have. I don't want a Harvey Lillard story in my office. It's a practice killer, isn't it? I don't like the miracle adjustment. I don't like the miracle nutrition response. Because what do they tell their friends? One visit. Oh, please, don't tell anybody that. And I have it happen. You know, for technique, I do Activator. And sometimes, especially with low back cases, I put them down, I clear L4, they get off the table. It's a miracle. I tell them, shh, don't say that. I'm glad for you. And I don't even believe that. I'll see you tomorrow. And let's see if this holds. If this holds, fine. But don't tell your friends. Because most of the time, it takes more. Don't tell them it's one shot, doc. And if we get the miracle response, I tell them, don't tell your friends how quickly it worked for you, because that's not usually the case. Just tell them, go see Dobbins. He did good work for me, helped me. All right. Any questions on pain?
Yes.